Freedom of Thought in Science, or Does Truth Need Guarding? Was presented by Charlie Dewberry at the 2008 Oktoberfest Conference, entitled Freedom of Thought, Hollow Slogan, or Purposeful Practice. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2008. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed, in whole, for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Well, my topic is freedom of thought in science. And, well, first of all, the story science tells itself is that freedom of thought is certainly a hallmark of science. In fact, they'd go much farther and say it's the heart and soul of science. I mean, the story of science is the pursuit of truth, right? I mean, that's the story science tells itself. After the movie and Dr. Crocker's talk, I'm not sure what I could add to convince you that there seems to be a disjunct between science's view of itself and the actual situation that it finds itself in. And I'm not sure what I could add to convince you if you aren't convinced at this point. Nothing in my experience, I would say, would come close to any of those things. So I'm basically going to begin this talk with the assumption that it seems to me that there is a problem with academic freedom in science. And it's a problem that I've had to wrestle with for about 30 years, but not for the same reasons that some of the other people have had to wrestle with it. And I'll describe a few of those events in my life here in just a few minutes. But my punchline is really that I see the problem with academic freedom in science differently than most people. It seems to me that it's not just a question of getting issues debated within the scientific arena. I think the problem is the scientific arena itself. And the scientific arena itself is, in fact, the major impediment to intellectual freedom. Well, how can that be? Because science tells the story of its development with the Copernicans. The development of modern science is the development of modern culture. It's when we moved out of that Middle Ages worldview to a more modern worldview. And science played a central role in that. And academic freedom was absolutely the central issue. So how can I possibly make an argument that there's a problem within science itself? I didn't always think this way. I didn't always think about this kind of a problem. In fact, it came to me very late. Up until I was 30, I really would have had no use for a Gutenberg-style education at all. I was a science geek from the time I was first or second grade. I knew what I was going to do. What good are the humanities? You know, why should we read all that ancient history? Why should we do all of that? It's irrelevant. On my way out to Oregon to start a PhD program at Oregon State, I picked up two books. I don't know why, but those two books fundamentally changed my life. One of them was Thomas Kuhn's The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, and the other was Michael Polanyi's Personal Knowledge. Now, I say I picked them up and I started to try to read them, but the first thing I realized was I didn't know how to read this kind of stuff because it wasn't science. So the first thing I noticed, it was really difficult reading and it was hard for me to figure out what it was arguing, but I got the gist of the two books. And the two books were saying that everything I'd been taught about what science is and how you do it isn't defensible. It's a caricature. It's a myth. And that was a problem for me. I mean, I'm starting a PhD program in science. And suddenly, here's two books that rip everything I've been taught for the last 15 years out from under me. And so the issue was, well, what am I going to do with that? And out of the struggle of what I'm going to do with that is the views that I've basically come to now. And I'd like to start by, well, I'd like to start by sharing a couple of events in my life that at first they'll seem disconnected, they're unconnected, but I want to show that they're really fundamentally about the same thing. The first one was, I'm an ecologist. I study salmon fisheries. The state of Oregon was, a few years ago, dealing with the listing, federal listing of a salmon species for the first time. So the issue is, how is Oregon going to address that problem? So the first thing they did was call a panel of scientists together. I mean, that's what we do when there's an issue of this kind. We'll call a panel of scientists together, and we'll figure out what needs to be done. And I was in the audience that day, and after the moderator made some introductory remarks, I got up and walked out because it was very clear to me that this wasn't going anywhere. What did he say? What he said was this. I went back and got a transcript. I'd like to add a couple comments about objectives. I think that if you look at the panel here, we have a collection of scientists, all with significant scientific credentials. All those scientific credentials come from their peers. These folks have a career that's been based on recognition through the peer review process. And so it is those credentials and their wisdom that's come over their careers that we would like to have them share with us today. On the other hand, I think if you took any one of those folks out for a beer, you'd find they had values and opinions. Our challenge today is to focus on the scientific credentials and to save those values and opinions for the tavern at 5:30 tonight. On the other hand, I suspect that we're going to find on this topic that the knowledge base is imperfect. We'll have to rely on the scientists to provide expert wisdom on their scientific perspectives. So in that regard, I think we might add one more objective. That would be to encourage an honest, forthright display of knowns, unknowns, and areas of disagreement about the cumulative effects of management activities on salmon. Then as you read the remaining objectives, I think they fit pretty well. But let us make sure that we do our best to separate the facts from values, opinions, or fiction about what's known about management activities on salmon. Unfortunately, you folks on the committee are going to be challenged to apply the information that's presented to you within the societal context that's full of politics, values, and opinions. You are the folks that have the challenge to take the science and put it into social, political, and economic context. So speakers, I guess I'd challenge you a bit, as with gunslingers at the bar. Please check your values and opinions at the door, at least initially. You'll help this process the most by sticking to the facts. Tell us what's known based on vigorous scientific tests. What is the scope of influence or how you can extrapolate the particular work you're speaking about and where there's honest disagreements about the interpretation of the data. And please share that uncertainty with you can. Okay, remember, at the end of the day, you folks on the policy panel have a chance to ask questions. So be thinking about the questions you want to ask. So that does not mean that you don't have questions early on, but this is your opportunity to learn. That was the introductory remarks made by the dean of the forestry school at Oregon State University with regards to how the state of Oregon was going to deal with salmon. I walked out because I think that the view of science he has and the role he sees science playing is the view that I'd basically been taught, and that after reading the two books I read, it was very clear to me that that was absolute nonsense. As a result of it, I went away and wrote this book, Saving Science. It's my answer to that question. So that's one incident. But the second one's a little closer to us. It happened just a couple years ago. After the Dover case with regard to intelligent design that was talked in the movie last night, I had vowed, even as a non-Christian when I was 30 and a Darwinian, that I would never get involved in the Darwinian wars, because that's what they are. They're wars. They're about annihilation. There isn't any interest in what's really true. All anybody wants to do is annihilate the other side. And it seemed to me that was my view of both sides, so I vowed I would never be part of it. But after the judge's ruling, I was so infuriated with the whole process, because it seemed from beginning to end, the whole thing was indefensible, unintelligible, and illiterate. So I wrote another book. Well, after I wrote that book, I sent a copy of this book to all the major players on both sides. I got one response. The response was from the Discovery Institute. I got that response about 3 days after I sent it to them. They thanked me for sending the book, and they asked me if I would sign the letter that Dr. Crocker mentioned, that they asked scientists to sign a letter, if they were scientists who at least supported the idea of asking whether intelligent design was a question that ought to be asked or not. I think that's the way the question was formatted. And so I said, yeah, sure, you can put my name on your list. 2 days later, they called me back and said, well, your book isn't helpful to us. And not only that, we removed your name from the list. And I thought for a minute, and they said, and by the way, why we're doing that is, see, your PhD is in philosophy. It's not in science. And my response was, oh, okay. But what I want to talk about for just a minute is, I think sometimes I am a scientist. I think I've actually done some science. And for a few minutes, I'd like to tell you a little about the science I've been able to do. And actually, there's one other reason I'd like to tell this. Is when I go on and talk about my ideas of where I've arrived at what I think science is and how it's done and why I think this is necessary, this discussion is actually necessary before there could be any intellectual freedom in science at all. I also want to head a critique off at the pass. I've had the opportunity to give this talk to scientists. And one of the immediate responses I get is this. Well, Charlie, it's just sour grapes, man. You didn't get your PhD in science. You weren't up to it. You couldn't stand the heat. You couldn't get your degree. This is just sour grapes. So for those folks, I would also like to tell you a little about my experience in science. I've spent the last 30 years of my life diving and counting salmon on the Pacific Rim. That's something I've wanted to do from the time I was 5 years old. So for the last 30 years, I've been able to dive in places from near San Francisco all the way across to Siberia. I worked for 10 years for a guy named Jim Sidell. I think he's the best stream ecologist in the world, and I'm not alone in that thinking. Secondly, I was one of the divers involved in developing what's called the Hankin and Reeves technique. It was a method that allowed us to look at the abundance and distribution of fish in river systems that's now used by all 50 states, all federal agencies, and most European countries. In 2004, as a member of the CIUSLA Watershed Council, we won the International TICE Award for the outstanding river restoration project in the world. And I wrote the science part of it, and I wrote the framework for the restoration plan for that work. And this August, I just completed what may be my last federal grant, but I just completed a federal grant that was worth over $1 million. So I would argue, at least at times, I think I've been a scientist. But what's interesting is, in a way, what's been my blessing is that I'm not considered a scientist because I don't have the credentials. That's a piece of what I would like to address. Is it seems to me, if you go back to the two instances, both the dean of the forestry school, when he laid out who were scientists and who had the expertise to be telling us the facts. And secondly, in the Discovery Institute, their view of science and their agenda was, here's what we want to do with intelligent design. We want to bring intelligent design into the scientific arena and have a fair and intellectual debate in the scientific arena. My point is that I think the scientific arena itself is a very impediment. It's an impediment to intellectual freedom. And in fact, when I went back and started to actually think about this, it looked to me like the science of the 20th century had more in common with the Catholic Church than it did with the Copernicans. Let me say that again. I think the science of the 20th and 21st century has more in common with the Catholic Church, not the Copernicans. What I'd like to do for a few minutes is unpack some of this. Where have I come? What is the problem with science? Well, first, let me tell you the understanding of science that I'm reacting to. It goes something like this. Science is a method, and many would call this method hypothesis testing. We make observations, measurements, we take those hypotheses, we test them with statistics. We write and publish in peer-reviewed journals. That's science. Let's unpack that. Science is a method. It's a mechanical method. And it's the method itself that ensures the outcome, not any bias or not any presupposition of the scientists themselves. The method separates the human side, if you will, that side, the biases and presuppositions of the individual scientist. And therefore, the results are more objective and certain than in other fields of endeavor. Let's take an example. Doesn't matter what your beliefs are, when we measure, we ought to get the same number, right? It doesn't matter what you believe about intelligent design or God or anything else. When we measure, we're all going to get the same number. That's the foundation of the certainty of science. It's based on measurement. If you can't quantify it, it's not science. As a result of that method, then, science is privileged information. That's why science sits on the pedestal. That's why we ask the scientists what they think. That's why the scientists in the modern world wear the robes of authority on what's true in the culture, because they got the method. They know the method. They've got the method. Lastly, peer review is also an important element of the scientific community. That's what ensures that essentially the tests were done appropriately, the facts were collected reasonably, and the authors don't go past the implications of the information they've collected in their writing in this argument. So peer review, and also peer review in constant testing. Anyone can go back and test anyone else's outcome. And so even if something false gets through science, it has this self-correcting mechanism. Science is going to correctly ascertain whether a hypothesis has been severely tested and whether you're going to reject it or not. Well, it's hard to talk about and critique a view that's never, ever been actually carefully articulated, and it's articulated slightly differently by some people, but that's more or less the view in general that I was taught, and that I'm absolutely convinced that almost every assertion in that is absolutely false. Well, how can I say that? What was it that was in the books, and what is it in my thought that's led me to that conclusion? First, if science is a method of testing hypotheses, then the first question is, who's a scientist? My problem is Copernicus, Galileo, Kepler, Newton. Let's start with them. They didn't test any hypotheses. That isn't what they did. So it strikes me that a definition of science that would rule those folks out, that can't possibly be right. So I have a problem right off the bat, because it looks to me like they were doing something very different from that. Notice also that if science is a mechanical method, if it's doing the method that ensures the results, then that's anti-intellectual. It's replacing thinking and judgment with a mechanical process, and that's exactly what it's doing. Statistics replaces judgment. We can't allow anyone to look at the evidence and say, well, does this support it or not? We replace the idea of human judgment with statistics that's mechanical. We let statistics make the decision for us because we're biased. It takes the human out one more time. This ideal picture of science would actually best be done by a machine. It wouldn't be best done by a human being at all. And in fact, if it could be done, most people, I think, would largely argue that it ought to be done by machines. And if you pay attention in lots of fields, that's exactly what's happening. The third problem I have with it is it's not defensible. It's never been defensible. And how can I possibly argue this? Well, let's look at the measurement thing. Let's look at the scientific method. What's the philosophical foundation of the scientific method? We measure. We have an observation, sense experience. Philosophically, it's going back to a person, David Hume. And it's basically taking Hume's philosophy and saying, this is the grounds upon which science can be certain. Why? Because look at what perception is. It's a sensation. It's an observation. When we perceive something, it just happens to us. Our mind is passive. It doesn't affect the object at all initially. Once we have the impression in our mind, then we can manipulate it. Then we can interpret it. But the impression itself enters the mind, and the mind's passive, so no biases, no presuppositions can get in the way. It's an idea of science that came from David Hume. And it explicitly came into the 20th century with scientists called the logical positivists. Another very common form of this view of science was that by a guy named Karl Popper. And Karl Popper basically argued that science is hypothesis testing. He's the person that really originated this idea. But another part of Popper's perspective was, and anyone who's taken much science is familiar with Popper's idea, that hypothesis testing is really what's called null hypothesis testing, meaning you never can prove anything true, you can only falsify it. See, because any number of positive indications, well, that's support, but it doesn't prove, certainly, that a hypothesis is true or not. It could just be you haven't done the experiment enough times. If you did the experiment enough times under a variety of conditions, you might finally get a false reading, so therefore it wouldn't be true. Well, we wouldn't know that till we did all the experiments. We couldn't know it was true. But Popper's argument was, but if we find a false one, then we know we've rejected it. So what he said was, take your hypothesis and then take the opposite of it. And if you can reject that, then you can say, well, I've tested my hypothesis and I haven't rejected it yet. But I can't say it's true. I can only say that I've tested it severely and not rejected it. That's Popper's view. What's my problem with Popper's view? It seems like his idea that you can falsify something has the same problem that the mirror image does, that you can prove it true. Let me give you an example. In the history of science, people took Newton's ideas and started to check them out. And when they checked Newton's ideas, he predicted that the outer planet would actually be in a different place than it was. Well, here we have a dilemma, because was this instance falsifying Newton's theory? Well, the scientists thought no. What it might be is there might be another planet out there, so they did the math and found the next planet. But the point of that is, how can you tell when you get a false reading if it's caused by something within your hypothesis or something you hadn't considered at all? Popper's answer to that is, well, you can test them all. But my point is, how do you test what you don't even know is a factor? So in the end, his theory of testing hypotheses has the same problem that he was pointing out on the other side, and that is no number of positive cases can ever prove your theory is true. You may not have looked at enough things yet, and you may not have looked at the right factors. So what I've concluded, and there's more, there's a number, and my critique is several hundred pages, so I've just thrown out part of it. But one of the things I've concluded is that science isn't a privileged endeavor. There's nothing unique about science. What characterizes science is not a method. What characterizes science is a subject matter. Science is no different from philosophy or history. The supposed scientific method that separates out biases and presuppositions, the method doesn't do that. Secondly, no one actually really ever follows that method. So, for example, if the method is just followed and that's it, every once in a while I get sent papers to peer review. The first question on a peer review list is this interesting? What does that have to do with this paper? I mean, interesting, that looks like a value to me. This isn't looking at the facts. You're just, as a peer reviewer, you're going to be looking at whether this is an interesting paper or not. That's a value. So even in the peer review process, you just smuggled values right in there. You can't separate them out. There's no way to ever get values out of science. It's just like history and philosophy. But I want to say, though, is that science, done carefully, can give us important, true information. But so can history and philosophy. So what I want to argue is science has no privileged place. The second thing I want to point out is the limits of science. For instance, intelligent design. Is intelligent design good science? Well, who should we ask? The society. Go pick up the New York Times. Who did they ask? They went to a panel of scientists. Are they the people that should answer that question? How does the scientific method help you sort out whether idea is good science? That's not a scientific question at all. And to take it to scientists is the height of, you know, illiteracy. Because it's not scientists with using the scientific method to tell you what good science is. That's philosophy. But science waxes eloquently on this. They'll tell you what they think about everything. And that came out of the 20th century because science was so privileged that early in the 20th century, there was a view that the only knowledge that exists is scientific knowledge. What's happening here is the scientists are willing to wax eloquently about subjects they know nothing about. And we all let them get away with it. I'd like to talk about peer review for just a minute. Because as I look at peer review, that's a return to the medieval model of science. That's a return back to the Middle Ages. Well, why do I say that? Let's look at Galileo. Galileo is a good person to look here at here. Galileo had to deal with peer review. And what I want to point out was, what was Galileo's response to peer review? And I'll even throw out, what was Luther's response to peer review? Because it seems to me that they're both inhaling the same air. They're both coming from the same place. The authority of science and the determination of what's true or not in science, what marks the modern period is we move from peer review, the priesthood, to the individual. So what does Galileo say when that question was put to him? So a guy named Sarcey is arguing that the Copernican theory must not be a good theory because it's been 60 years and they have very few followers. So if there's no followers, this must not be a very good theory. And so he's arguing against Galileo, saying, this can't be a good theory because you don't have any followers. Here's what Galileo says. Perhaps Sarcey believes that all the hosts of good philosophers, and he means scientists here, may be enclosed within four walls. I believe that they fly, and that they fly alone, like the eagles, and not in flocks like starlings. It's true that because eagles are rare birds, they're rarely seen and less heard. While birds that fly like starlings fill the sky with shrieks and cries, wherever they settle, they befoul the earth beneath them. Yet if true philosophers are like eagles, they are not unique like the phoenix. There's a crowd of fools who know nothing, Sarfi, and their number is infinite. Those who know a little philosophy are numerous. Few indeed are those who really know some part of it, and there's only one who knows all of it. To put aside all hints and to speak plainly and deal with science as a method of demonstration and reason capable of human pursuit, I hold that the more this partakes of perfection, the smaller number of propositions it will promise to teach, the fewer yet it will conclusively prove. Consequently, the more perfect it is, the less attractive it will be, and the fewer its followers. On the other hand, magnificent titles and many grandiose promises attract the natural curiosity of men and hold them forever involved in fallacies without ever offering him a single sample of that sharpness of true proof by which the taste may be awakened to know how insipid is the ordinary fare of science. Such things will keep an infinite number of men preoccupied, and that man will indeed be fortunate who, led by some inner light, can turn from dark and confused labyrinth in which he might have gone on perpetually winding with the crowd, and he might become more entangled. Hence, I consider it not very sound to judge a man's philosophical opinions by the number of his followers. Yet, though I believe the number of disciples of the best philosophy is small, I do not conclude, conversely, that the opinions and doctrines are necessarily perfect, which have few followers, for I know well enough that some men hold some opinions so erroneous as to be rejected by everybody else. But from which source the two authors mentioned by Sarcey derives the scarcity of their followers, I do not know, because I haven't looked at their works carefully enough. His point is that the authority of science, and the authority of which science is going to claim something is true or not, resides with the individual. I don't know where, but we return to the Middle Ages view of the priesthood. We just have a new priesthood. The scientific community of peer reviewers is now the new priesthood. We've replaced the Copernican view of science with the medieval view of science. There's one other observation I would like to make about the scientific method that we talked about before. There's really three positions you can take philosophically with regard to what can be known. One is called skepticism. Skepticism basically says we can't know what's true. We can ultimately know what's true. What science is about is prediction. So science is good at telling us how things are going to look or what's going to happen in the future or in the past. Science is about prediction, that's all. For those of you who've read many of the authors in the Copernican Revolution, Osiander, who wrote the preface to Copernicus's work, is an example of a skeptic. He said, now don't get the idea Copernicus is actually arguing his theories true. This is just a new method of a mechanical way of predicting where the planets are going to be. He isn't saying this is true now. He's just saying this is a different method of doing the calculations. That's Osiander and the skeptics. The second view you can take is empirically based realism. This was actually the position of the Catholic Church in the debate. I mean, we have the myth that says it was Galileo defending the view of science and the method of science of observation and experiment against the Catholic Church, who believed their ideas based on faith in the Bible. That's what this was about. That's bunk. That's nowhere near the truth. Here's what Bellarmine, who was the leading Catholic theologian at the time, who was given the job of evaluating the church's position. Here's what he said. It looks to me that the Ptolemaic and Copernican theories are empirically identical. There's no empirical way to tell them apart. As a result, without an empirical evidence that their theory is better than the other theory, I think the Copernicans are wrong for claiming their theory is true, because they don't have empirical evidence. That's the church's position. There's one more view of science you can take, and that's what I would call rational realism. Let me read an example of what I would call a rational realist, Galileo. In the middle of his dialogue, and he wrote this, well, you should read it and ask yourself why he wrote it. But the question has come up, about why there are so few followers of the Pythagoreans, or he means the Copernicans. Here's what he says. You wonder that there are so few philosophers of the Pythagorean opinion, or I'm astonished that there's been any up to this day who've embraced it and followed it. Nor can I ever sufficiently admire the outstanding acumen of those who have taken hold of this opinion and accepted it as true. They have, through sheer force of intellect, done such violence to their own senses as to prefer what reason told them over what sensible experience plainly showed them to the contrary. Well, what's he saying? What he's saying is this. Why were there so few followers of Copernicus? It's really pretty simple. Get up in the morning and watch the sun come up. What do you see? You see the sun come up. The sun moves. We're sitting still. That's what you see. Well, what would even suggest the Copernican theory? The answer is, it's intellectual. There's something so rational about that theory that they're going to set aside their empirical sense experience for a higher standard. It's rational. It's intellectual. Where's modern science sit? Which of those three views does modern science hold? The first, remember, was skeptical. You can't know. All those who are proponents of Popper's theory, or variations of it, are skeptics. Notice what they say. We never can prove it true. We just haven't falsified it yet. That's skepticism. Secondly, empirical-based realism. There are people that do hold an empirical-based realism. But the third one, that's not even acceptable in the 20th century as a reason, as grounds for any scientific theory. You'd be laughed out of any peer review panel if you went up and made an intellectual claim. Modern science is anti-intellectual. The scientific method is anti-intellectual. It's replacing thinking and judgment with a mechanical process that looks at observation and uses statistics to replace judgment. So in conclusion, my journey has taken me far away from virtually anybody else I know. It seems to me that it's pretty clear there isn't academic freedom within science. But I would argue that a major part of the problem actually lies within science itself. The causes are rooted in the scientific institutions themselves. We need to recover science itself. I want to help recover science. I'm worried that the view of science that's taken and the position scientists take in such controversies as the Darwinian and intelligent design debate, it doesn't bode well for science because they're making arguments that are irrational, illiterate, don't jive with their own history, that are incoherent. I could go on for a while longer. But I would say, firstly, we need to recover the idea of science that was started by the Copernicans. And there's one other thing I'd like to just note about the Copernicans. Notice that Copernicus, Galileo, Kepler, Newton, all of them were theists. I don't think that's just happenstance. And you can see it in virtually all of them. What is it that they're expecting? God created a rational universe that makes sense. That's the ground of modern science. If we really write the history of science, it ought to be that I think it was their belief in God, in fact, that was one of the most important steps that led to the Copernican Revolution itself, the very point modern science wants to deny. I've also argued that I don't think science, I would deny that they have a privileged role in the debate. If a question is intelligent design science, scientists ought to say, well, heck, I don't know. I can't use scientific method to figure that out. That's a philosophical question. Go ask them. Go ask the philosophers. Oh, they wax really eloquently about stuff they don't have any idea. So last, I'd like to say that we ought to recognize the proper role of science, and that is science does have a role. Science does deal with facts. It's bringing important information to all these debates, but it's no more important than history, philosophy, religion. It has no higher place. So I would argue that the table we set up to try to have these debates, intelligent discourses about things, the table and all the people that we bring around the table are all the wrong people talking about all the wrong stuff. And that's largely why there is no intelligent discourse nor academic freedom in science. Thank you.